Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. We're diving into the Trapital voicemails for this episode. This is our mailbag episode, but we're doing things differently. In our past mailbag episodes, we have gotten questions that we've read them aloud on the show, but for this one, we're hearing directly from you. Listeners sent in their voice messages with their questions on the business of music and entertainment. And we're also doing things differently because normally we pick about five or six of these, but I think less is going to be more for this one. So we're only picking three of them, and I want to dive into each of them because they're really good questions and things that I've been thinking about for a while. So let's start with our first question.
Hey, what's good? Mavi here. Thank you for your show. I'm still thinking about the TikTok versus Universal war because I think it would end sooner, to be honest. I think both parties really lose a lot in this war. And I want to ask, what do you think will happen? Who's losing more? And when do you think this will end? Because it's taking way longer than I thought.
Mavi, you're starting us off with the elephant in the room. Everyone's trying to figure this out. How long will the dispute between UMG and TikTok continue? My best guess is that this is not ending anytime soon. And here's a few reasons why. First off, before we even get to the UMG and TikTok dispute, we need to talk about UMG specifically over the past 2.5 years. And I specifically single out the past 2.5 years because this is when UMG went public. And ever since UMG went public, there's been a lot that has changed with the mentality, the focus, and the objectives of this company. So let's go back to September 2021. UMG goes public. Everyone makes a ton of money. There's new investors. Folks like Bill Ackman from Pershing Square get 7.1% of the company. And everyone is thinking that this thing is going to continue. But they also see tremendous opportunity to look at this capital light business and extract more value, especially how much money is A, being left on the table, and B, how much more headway there is. These investors and the stakeholders, they want to see returns, especially given the quarterly basis. This is different than being owned by Vivendi. Vivendi looked at this many ways as a healthy cash cow, music and the asset. It was the highest margin aspect of the music industry and the business, and it continued to generate good returns. However, when you're a publicly traded company, especially compounded with the fact that streaming growth is now slowing and streaming is the main thing that saved this industry, there's going to be a lot more question marks about where things look like in the future. And a lot of those question marks can be seen through a lot of the press releases and the public focus that we've seen from UMG in the past couple of years. Look at all of the memos that we've seen from Lucian Grange over the past couple of years. The pressure to cut out whale noise and to focus on professional artists. These streaming thresholds that artists need to be able to hit in order to start generating revenue from the platform. And the pressure that has been put on Spotify and the other DSPs to raise prices and continue to raise prices. And as a result, we've seen the stock price for UMG respond positively. Right around the IPO time, September 2021, UMG debuted at around 23 euros per share. There was definitely a dip that we saw after that in 2022 and 2023. But so far in Q1, it's been able to reach and exceed those all-time highs and is currently fluctuating between 26 and 27 euros per share. And the other big thing that we've seen from UMG in the past few recent months is the restructuring of the label and some of the personnel changes that we've seen. Yes, we've seen a number of layoffs despite the health of the business. I think a lot of that is a bit of the correction that we've seen happen overall in the economy and the tech adjacent companies. But specifically, we've also seen the restructuring of the label where a lot of the labels that are in the UMG umbrella have either become absorbed or have morphed into essentially two distinct labels. You have UMG East and you have UMG West as well. UMG East following under the Republic Records leadership of the Litmans and several of the labels that fall under there. And then on the West Coast side, it's the Interscope, Geffen, A&M, the leadership from John Janik and others that are part of that group with Capital and others that are combined into them. So for my basketball fans out there, it's helpful to think about the new ownership and transition of UMG, like how you think about a basketball team when it switches owners. We've seen the Phoenix Suns, for instance. Matt Ishbia took over ownership of that team, spent more money than anyone ever spent on an NBA team. What does he do? He goes and gets Kevin Durant. You know why he gets Kevin Durant? Because that's what new owners do when they're in this big situation. You saw this decades earlier when Mark Cuban had taken control and ownership of the Dallas Mavericks. He went and spent money on Rafe LaFrance and players like that. This is the type of thing that we've seen. There's a bit more of a private equity push to it, just given some of the moves that we've seen with UMG. But this is what happens when there's new ownership in general. You're going to see changes, and you're going to see changes, especially for a company that was bought at the peak heights of the pandemic. Again, this isn't Vivendi that's been sitting on this asset for over a decade when it was worth a tenth of what it's worth now. No, this is a company that bought at the peak of the pandemic and wants to make sure that it can maximize that investment and trim any of the fat and maximize it in other areas. And that's exactly what we're seeing. And now that we have that piece laid out, now we can get into the TikTok of it all. A lot of these stats are stats that you probably know if you're listening to this episode. TikTok does not pay a lot of money for the music that it licenses. It has these global licenses with all of the major record labels and a lot of the indie labels too, but it's not that high. We read the Universal Music Group letter that it put out, and it said that TikTok accounts for less than 1% of its revenue. For context, this is an app that has 1.5 billion monthly active users. This is an app where the Financial Times recently reported that there was $16 billion worth of revenue only in the US from TikTok. But still, this is an app that generates less money for Universal Music Group than Peloton. While TikTok has 1.5 billion monthly active users, Peloton has 1/500th of that with 3 million users. While TikTok has $16 billion worth of revenue in the US, Peloton had less than $3 billion of revenue in 2023. And while TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, is valued at over $200 billion, Peloton's current market cap is $1.5 billion. Sure, it may not be an apples to apples comparison to compare a free app that anyone can download on their smartphone to a paid subscription service for something that people also likely need a hardware product for in Peloton. But the difference is still stark. Another thing that we hear often with UMG and TikTok is the historical precedence that looks at the last time that a major record label pulled its music from a platform that leaned on the promotional argument as opposed to being a revenue generation play. And that's what we saw with Warner Music and YouTube when it pulled its music off the platform over 15 years ago. That only lasted 9 months, and there are some similarities, but there are also some big differences. And the biggest difference is that the music industry is in a much stronger position than it was in 2008. In 2008, the business was floundering. A lot of hip-hop artists out there were making more money from ringtones than they were from recorded music. Back in 2008, YouTube, which was acquired by Google at that point, had a lot more leverage against Warner Music Group than TikTok currently has against UMG today. UMG, again, is in a much stronger position. And to state the obvious, TikTok has a lot that they're dealing with on their plate right now, even outside of the UMG dispute that's going on. They're in a big geopolitical challenge right now with the US government threatening a ban of the product if there isn't a sale to a US company. TikTok is doing its best to stand its ground on that, but we've already heard President Biden say that if that bill comes to his desk, he will pass it. And according to the Wall Street Journal, we've already seen some growth slow for TikTok. This is the first time in its period that it is stagnating with growth. And it comes for a few reasons, with IG Reels gaining ground. There's a softer advertising market than there was in the past. Some of these challenges have nothing to do with what's going on with the UMG TikTok or even the ban itself. A lot of these platforms, we saw it happen with the streaming services, are no longer in their hyper growth phase. They all go into a mature phase. And on one hand, that comes from a sign of strength, just given how much of the market they have. But it also weakens the power of you being able to say you're going to continue to grow at X and X level, because there is a cap and there is only so many users out there. The next part that you and I have to talk about is the impact of the ban and the actual implementation of it. Let's start with the impact, and let's do that by looking at who the top artists are. This is a power law driven business. And if anyone is going to be driving the revenue, everyone's asking, who are the top artists that we should be concerned about? 2023, here are the top 10 artists in the US from TikTok. 1, Selena Gomez. 2, Natalie Jane. 3, Ice Spice. 4, Meghan Trainor. 6, Miley Cyrus. 7, Cardi B. 8, NLE Choppa. 9, Lil Mabu. And 10, Lizzo. Of those artists, you have number 1, Selena Gomez, which is a UMG artist. Natalie Jane is UMG. Ice Spice is. Ariana Grande. And the rest are all on other record labels. If you look at Selena Gomez, this is an artist that hasn't released an album in over 4 years and is now, to be honest, more known for acting than she is for music. Natalie Jane, very popular on TikTok, but if you look at her Spotify numbers, she doesn't have a song with more than 80 million Spotify streams as of this recording in March 2024. So this is more of a TikTok thing, not necessarily driving meaningful revenue at this moment. Ice Spice, much more popular on both Spotify and socials than Natalie Jane is. But again, we still haven't seen a big album release that has topped all the charts, sold hundreds of thousands of units per week, had hundreds of millions of streams for the album. We just haven't seen that yet. It could happen in the future. We haven't seen that yet. So it's really only one artist that's releasing new music that is at the top of these charts for UMG. That's Ariana Grande. She's number 5th on our list. And coincidentally, she just released her most recent studio album, Eternal Sunshine. Eternal Sunshine almost had 200 million on-demand streams in its first week. Its numbers were right there with Sweetener, her 2018 album. They surpassed her 2020 album positions, not quite as much as Thank You Next, but granted, that's the biggest album that she's had so far. And it netted her biggest vinyl week yet that she's had, selling over 33,000 vinyl sales and counting. That's just from the first week. So it's hard to say that Ariana Grande took a knock from having her music not being able to be promoted or released on TikTok. If you're UMG, why would you be in any rush to try to resolve this TikTok thing or bend to their will any further when you just had one of the biggest stars on one of the biggest record labels that you have within your music group have one of the biggest releases that she's had since pre-pandemic? So there's a lot of reasons we've talked about here that build the case for why I don't see UMG bending the knee to TikTok anytime soon. But there are a few things that work in the favor of TikTok that we should discuss. First off, if we go back to Ariana Grande, if you go to her TikTok page right now, you could still hear some of those songs from Eternal Sunshine or even some of the other albums still on her page. There's been several good write-ups about this from both Variety and Music Business Worldwide that have counted and looked at several of the popular songs from artists that are on UMG, either on the recorded music side or the publishing side, and their songs are still there. And that's for a few reasons. One, the ability to take down and mute these songs or just make sure that you can't hear them on the platform until these negotiations are resolved isn't as straightforward as it may seem. There's a few things happening. First off, this takes good, strong technology, and this is something that YouTube has gotten very good at, but it took decades for YouTube to build this. TikTok hasn't necessarily built this in the same type of way, and in certain ways, TikTok has an even tougher job than YouTube did before because a lot of the music that's put on TikTok is altered. According to PEX, 38% of the songs on the platform are slightly adjusted in some way, whether it's the speed or the tempo. So sometimes if you look on TikTok or on any of these platforms, you'll see the label as original sound instead of the actual name of the song. And that's because it technically is a sound that isn't registered as a song. And it's a lot tougher to pick that up. And that doesn't even get into hearing a song in the background as opposed to embedding it directly, or the challenges of a live performance, like if an artist is performing at a late night show or an award show or something like that, and then that version of the song gets uploaded, that then counts as a live performance, so it isn't necessarily the same track, who owns that music. A lot of these things can fall into this gray area, and to be honest, that still benefits TikTok in a lot of ways, because even though UMG has this ban and is UMG sharing the information about these new releases to still make sure that those new releases could be banned on TikTok, especially if they're not at the best terms with this partner, a lot of those things can make it a little bit tougher to navigate and figure out each of these things. So that's where we're at. If 2023 was the big year that we saw in Hollywood and entertainment with the writer's strike, then 2024 is the big standoff that we see with streaming and the social video platforms as well, specifically with UMG and TikTok. Will we see either side budge? I think we'll likely see the short form video platform budge before we see the recorded music company budge. But I also think that TikTok has a number of things that are affecting its current position that it may need to resolve. And I don't see UMG changing its position anytime soon, especially until ByteDance more broadly figures out what its next move is, especially for the future of this company in the United States. Let's take a break for this week's chart metric stat of the episode. If you're a parent of a young kid, you probably know the Bluey theme song by heart. Well, in November and December of 2023, the official Bluey account on Spotify averaged just over 920,000 monthly active listeners. Now, as of March 19th, that number has jumped to over 1.4 million listeners. The Bluey popularity train continues, and a lot of that likely lines up with the release of 10 episodes of Series 3 Part 3 that were added to Disney Plus on January 12th, 2024. It's another fascinating example about how the release of content on different platforms can lead to huge jumps, especially for one of the most popular children's programs there is. Let's get back to the episode. So now let's hear our next question.
Hey, Dan, what's up? This is Jeff, aka Mr. Boo Daddy, out of Denver, Colorado. Love listening to Trap Roll every week whenever it comes out. Question for you. I am in the kids music space. I create Beastie Boys for babies, kids music that actually rocks, inspired by my five-year-old son, Hendrix. Been doing it ever since he was born because the kids music out there was driving me crazy, so I thought I could do it better. The question is, hey, what's going on in the children's music space? Can you do a deep dive, come up with any interesting insights or facts, stats, trends in the kids' music space? I'd be really interested in exploring that and hearing what you guys came up with. Thanks, Dan.
So first off, thank you, Mr. Boo Daddy, for the question. I went to the website and listened to the music, and you are right. Beastie Boys for Kids is a very accurate description. So thanks for sending that in. Thanks for what you do. This question is also very timely for me now, having two young kids in the household and the music that we play, we think a lot about, and also the music that we don't play too. In our household right now, there's a lot of Gracie's Corner. I'll occasionally check out Kids Bop, but the big thing, which is should be no surprise to any other parent, is Bluey, and specifically the music from Bluey. Even though our kid hasn't watched an episode of that show, there's just a perk up that she has whenever she hears it, which is fascinating, which sparked me to do some digging in here, because I think there's a few interesting things that have been happening with the popularity of this show. So in 2023, it was, according to Nielsen, the second highest acquired streaming program in the U.S., with 43.9 billion minutes consumed. And that's only behind Suits, a show that in many ways only reached its height of notoriety because of Meghan Markle being on the show and then it being on Netflix, which is the biggest streaming platform. So for Bluey to be able to have those stats on Disney Plus, which is a streaming platform that has far less subscribers than Netflix does, is impressive and says a lot to the audience and everyone that it's able to reach there. And we also do have some stats that we'll share in this week's Chart Metrics Stat of the Week that specifically tie back to some of the streaming numbers that we've seen there, which we know that our household can definitely connect with. The one thing that I do want to highlight, though, that's been fascinating to me, though, this is a bit more on the overall entertainment and TV side of things with Bluey, but Bluey overtook Cocomelon. If you look at the reports and the data, especially in the beginning of the pandemic or the late 2010s, it was Cocomelon that was the phase that we would hear about. We would hear about how Cocomelon had more minutes watched than people watching Squid Games and Bridgerton combined, and how its parent company, Moonbug, was acquired for $3 billion. Now, that deal happened, peak pandemic. It's when we saw a lot of those Candle Media deals, whether it was with Spring Hill or Hello Sunshine or Westbrook Media and some of the others. However, it's still important to note because I do think that Cocomelon was the show that definitely had the juice. But it's also interesting too because if you compare a show like Cocomelon, which is this 3D show, it's very beautiful when you look at it. But then you look at a show like Bluey, it's two-dimensional. The graphics may not be nearly as impressive, but the content and what's actually being said and how it resonates, especially how things in different cultures can captivate people, especially if things don't necessarily line up all the way in English. It's like this perfect mix of things. First, on the 2D versus 3D thing, it made me think a lot of the big popularity that Nintendo Wii had back in the aughts when platforms like PS3, which really wasn't the strongest platform, it was definitely Xbox 360 that definitely ate its lunch for that generation of things. Nintendo Wii had its moment too, so even though these major gaming console companies were so focused on pushing the limits of graphics and capability and how realistic everything was, it was Nintendo that came in with these fun games that you could do in your living room, whether it was Wii Golf or Wii Tennis and all of these things. And it was really cool to see that it reset things where, yes, graphics are great, but what do people want? People want storytelling. People want to be able to feel like there's interactivity. And Bluey kind of reminds me of a lot of that. And I think the Bluey note feels especially true when you take a step back and look at animation more broadly. You look at a company like Pixar. Pixar was a company that had the juice for decades, dating back to the original Toy Story movie in 1995. But these movies just got more and more expensive to make. And especially if you can't guarantee that the next franchise you launch is going to be the next Incredibles or the next Toy Story or any one of these that now have had number of sequels, it's tough to spend $150, $200 million worth of cost and budget on a new story that you can't necessarily guarantee can still make sure that it can sell plastic and sell theme parks and all of the things that Disney likes to be able to do. And Bluey in some ways feels like the exact opposite of that because, yeah, it may not have the 100 plus year history that Walt Disney does, but the adoration that people have for this show, which I can guarantee you is much cheaper to make than a lot of the Cocomelon or even a lot of the Disney products, it's really cool to be able to see. So I'm going to continue to follow and watch these trends as it happen. And especially as a parent, I'm going to continue to dig into this and maybe we'll see a further deep dive on this topic at some point in the future. So now let's take our final question.
Hey Dan, we all know that the Super Bowl is prime real estate for ads every year. But what I don't know is, what does Verizon get out of airing a commercial promoting Beyonce's latest release?
So I saved this question for now because we have an official release date for Beyonce's upcoming album. Cowboy Carter comes out on March 29th, 2024. This is a country album, and this is an album that she's been doing a soft launch to a harder launch ever since she had that cowboy hat that she wore at the Grammys. And then the following week, she does this Verizon Super Bowl commercial. So to go to the question, what does Verizon get out of having Beyonce in its Super Bowl commercial? Well, number one is the association that a brand like Verizon has with one of the most popular artists in the world, Beyonce. And it's an opportunity to also combine her announcement with their product in this funny and in this engaging way. And it also stands out because we haven't necessarily seen Beyonce in this funny and engaging way. There's this funny internet joke that I've seen people make that we haven't seen Beyonce this animated in a TV or commercial spot since the early Destiny's Child days, where there was that viral video of her talking about how much she loves whales and things like that. A lot of the things that we've seen more recently are these more controlled and guarded interviews that you may see in British Vogue or one of those sites. Not necessarily in a bad way, but that's just what we see, especially in the age where the celebrities can curate a bit more of their image. You don't necessarily see a lot of that. So it was funny and engaging in that way. It is an opportunity to combine that product. And especially when you saw the results on the Verizon side, Verizon scored the highest peak in online ad conversions with more than 2,500 mentions in 1 minute, according to Brandwatch. Only Temu, the company that also advertised in the Super Bowl, had more after the game or even during the game. So these companies, especially these major brand companies like Verizon or the insurance companies or others, when they do major advertising spends, they're concerned about brand lift. And if your brand lift is associated with one of the biggest artists in the world releasing an album, that's huge. You're going to take that opportunity. The Beyonce Verizon commercial also reminds me a lot of the topics that we talked about in the insurance episode that Marcus Collins and I did back in January leading up to the show. A lot of the non-sexy industries often rely on humor and other things to stay relevant. Look at the AT&T commercials where we saw they had Lily from AT&T, where that character felt similar to the type of character that we would see in the commercial, in the insurance commercials like Flo and others. Even dating back to Verizon, when we saw some of the early ads that they had in the early 2000s, remember the, can you hear me now? Good. Those are funny. Those are memorable. And that's how these brands get ahead. Yes, they all have the commercials where they talk about the expansiveness of their network, but at some point, whether one network reaches 99.7% of the coverage in the United States or another one reaches 99.4%, those things can tend to gloss over a bit. But if you have something distinct, who else, AT&T or Sprint or Mint Mobile, can't say that Beyonce announced their album there. So these are the things that you do in order to push things forward. And especially when you look at the spot that Verizon had. So it was a 60-second spot on the actual commercial itself that aired during the Super Bowl. And they had the 90-second version of it that was on the YouTube channel. So the average cost of these advertising spots, they said, was $7 million. Let's assume that they got a bit of a cut since it was a 60-second one, and let's say it cost somewhere between $10 to $12 million. Whatever Verizon paid Beyonce to do the spot, it ends up being worth it, because why else would you be willing to spend the money for a commercial like that if you're not willing to make a big splash? It's not like the other commercials don't have big artists too. You look at the Booking.com commercial, it costs money to have Tina Fey. You look at the Dunkin' Donuts commercial, it costs money to have Ben Affleck. If you're going to put the money towards the budget, you're going to spend all of these other things with it too. So that's how these brands do it, especially these brands that we see them and the other companies in their industry advertising the Super Bowl year after year. I will say though, with Beyonce and Verizon specifically, there was one opportunity that I was eager to see if it was going to play out or not. And that was whether or not there was going to be a deeper cell phone partnership between Beyonce and Verizon. Because this is something that we've seen Jay-Z do several times. I'll link to the essay that I wrote in Trapital a few years ago, but it highlights how Jay-Z has worked with different cell phone companies that have essentially bought his album, bought his music, and then sold it to their users for free or had some type of deal. Jay did this most recently in 2017 with Sprint in the 444 album, where Sprint bought a portion of Tidal, and then as part of the deal, it was to help promote this 444 album. Jay-Z did a similar type of deal with Samsung 4 years before that in 2013, where Samsung bought millions of copies of Magna Carta Holy Grail and then gave that to its customers for free if they opted into it. Jay turned his albums into B2B products. That's how we did it. So part of me wondered, is that the angle that Beyonce's going for with this? Are we going to see something like that similarly? At this point, though, I doubt that's the case, and here's why. First off, we haven't seen anything reported like that with the release. It appears to be that Cowboy Carter can be streamed and listened to wherever you listen to music, or can be bought or purchased in vinyl or any of those formats where it's available. That's how Beyonce released her Renaissance album in 2022. This album, Cowboy Carter, is a continuation of Renaissance, so I would be surprised if she changed things up there. That's the first reason. The second reason is that 2024 is a very different time frame and environment than the 2010s when Jay-Z did these deals. Think back to cell phones and the type of carrier partnerships and the type of relationships that consumers had with their phones back then. In 2013, the Samsung Galaxy 3 was a very formidable competitor to the current version of the iPhone that was there. I knew a lot of my friends that had them, and Samsung definitely was putting a lot of effort behind this, and that was an example of Jay-Z partnering with an underdog brand that had some clout to help make that happen. And he did the same thing on the carrier side with Sprint as well. It's also important to remember those first few years of the iPhone. From 2007 to 2011, this was a product that was exclusive to AT&T. It wasn't on Verizon until 2011. That's a reminder of how fragmented the market was. And when the market's that fragmented, you're more likely to see deals like these happen. Now, the market is so much more mature. Even if Verizon had an exclusive look for the first 2 weeks of Beyonce's album, and anyone that's on the Verizon network can download Cowboy Carter, if you have AT&T or if you have another service, are you really going to switch carriers and switch your whole family plan over to Verizon just to get that album? You're probably not. I'm not going to. That's a much higher level of friction than it is to sign up for a streaming service for a set amount of time. And they're not even going to do that because we're well past the days of streaming exclusives as well. So that's a reminder to show how much has changed and how far we've come. And I still think that this deal was really cool. The partnership, the way that we've been able to see Beyonce, especially in this lighthearted way that we saw in the video for this commercial. So I think it made sense for Verizon, especially considering the brand lift. But I don't think that any of the other ideas that I had necessarily will come to fruition. But we'll see. So that's it for this episode. We're keeping it to 3 topics for this one. I think less is more with this. I really enjoyed these topics, and I think we'll probably dig into each of these, especially the UMG and TikTok one that we have as well. So definitely let me know what you think, and we'll talk to you next time. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to 1 or 2 people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.